Chapter 6 The Path of Meditation Verses 1 and 2
Shri Bhagavan Uvacha Anashrita Karma Phalam Karyam Karma Karoti Yaha Sa Sanyasi Cha Yogi Cha Na Niragdir Na Chakriyaha Yam Sanyasamiti Prahur Yogam Tam Viddhi Pandava Na Hyasanyasta Sankalpo Yogi Bhavati Kaschana
The Blessed Lord said, Without resorting to the fruit of action, he who performs the action that needs to be done, he is a renunciate and a yogi, and not one who has renounced ritual fires, nor one who is actionless. That which is called renunciation, you should know that to be yoga, O Pandava. No one who has not renounced desires can become a yogi. The previous chapter teaches that renouncing desire for worldly pleasure and gain helps one to attain control over the mind. By giving up desires and gaining control over the mind, one can attain liberation. The highest liberation is attained only with self-realization. In the first and second verses of this chapter, Sri Krishna says that sannyasa, renunciation, and karma yoga, the path of action, share certain requisites, performing one's own duty without any desire for the fruits, controlling the senses and the mind, and attaining a state of tranquility. Now, let us describe these two paths without considering one to be superior and one inferior, and find out how they are distinct. In the path of renunciation, renouncing the fruits of actions comes later. First comes tyaga, literally abandoning all of one's personal possessions. Three main desires called three asanas are renounced. The desire for a spouse and children, for wealth, and for name and fame. Along with this, the practice of non-attachment, vairagya, is also strengthened, without which renunciation cannot be accomplished. It is said that a bird having two wings, tyaga and vairagya, is able to soar from this shore of life to the shore of eternity. The renunciate who is firmly established in the art of non-attachment and who has nothing of his own is a true renunciate. Such a renunciate is rare and is always revered because it is not easy to renounce the world of mine and thine. This path is for the fortunate few and not for the ordinary masses. It is called Sannyasa Yoga, or Jnana Yoga. The other path is the path of action. In that path, one can have a wife, children, a home, and other means for living in the world, but non-attachment is strictly followed. In the path of action, there is an important question to be considered. Is it possible for the yogis who follow the path of action to perform actions in such a way that they do not create barriers and obstacles? Can action become the means of liberation and lead one to self-realization, the goal of human life? There are two main responses. First, good actions performed selflessly and with the fruits given as offerings to the Lord, who is in everyone, have no binding power. Selfless service is important. Second, good actions also bring good fruits. And those fruits can be utilized merely to enable one to live in the world so that he can discharge his duties effectively. No matter which path one follows, he has to do actions. He cannot live without acting. Therefore, it is important to understand the nature of an action before one performs that action, whether he is doing sattvic action with self-mastery or is being controlled by rajasic or tamasic qualities. And acting as a slave to those qualities. Sattvic actions alone lead one to the state of tranquility. Sattvic actions, performed without the desire for fruits, are considered to be liberating actions. All other actions bind the human being. Yogis who wish to attain the state of tranquility do their actions and duties selflessly and skillfully. They have all the necessary objects of the world, but use them just for the sake of doing their duties. Many students wonder how it is possible for anyone to realize the pure self while doing his duties. For the renunciates say that without complete renunciation, self-realization is not possible. Renunciates also do their duties, but only for self-realization. They do not believe in doing actions for the people of the world. Renunciation is an inward journey, whereas the path of action is external, though the aim of both paths is one and the same. In the path of action, there are allurements, charms, and temptations. In the path of renunciation, it is the samskaras, latent impressions, that are not yet dealt with, that are the obstacles. Samskaras have a deep impact on human life. Because of their samskaras, yogis on the path of action are often led to do something that is not to be done. Therefore, purification of mind, action, and speech must be constantly practiced in both paths. These two paths have one and the same goal, though they seem to be distinct. Neither should be considered superior or inferior. In practicality, the real yogis and sannyasins are one and the same. On both the paths of action and renunciation, the key point is renouncing the fruits of actions. Those who have renounced the path of action but still lust for the fruits of action are not true renunciates. In the path of renunciation, no external sacred fire is lit, and no sacrifice is offered to the fire. Rather, renunciates light the fire of knowledge and burn their samskaras. The path of renunciation is also referred to as yoga, for in the path of renunciation, anything and everything is renounced, but not the purpose, which is union of the individual self with the self of all. That union is attained by the renunciate through meditation and contemplation. In the path of action, one can attain that union by giving up all the fruits of actions and remaining completely non-attached. Verses 3 and 4.
Arurukshor muner yogam karma karana muchyate, yoga rudhasya tasyaiva shamak karana muchyate. Yadahi nendriyartheshu na karma svanushajyate, sarva sankalpa sanyasi yoga rudhastadochyate.
For a meditator, Muni, desirous of ascending in yoga, action is said to be a supportive means. And when the same one has already risen in yoga, tranquility becomes his support. When he is no longer drawn to the objects of senses, nor to actions, having renounced all volitions of desire, he is then called one who has ascended to yoga. One who wants to have perfect control over the mind and its modifications should master his internal states. It is only possible for one to attain that control when he learns to practice in silence. A muni is one who practices mauna, silence, in order to attain perfect silence. When the muni makes efforts to achieve profound control over mind, action, and speech, and maintains perfect silence, he attains the state of tranquility. Until one experiences perfect silence, he is not aware of the profound difference between leading a life in the external world and treading the path of the inward journey. Silence is not understood by most people, and is experienced by only a few mendicants. For unless one fathoms the deepest state of silence, silence is only a word, and one does not comprehend its meaning. Every human being wants to be in silence for some time. We often hear a mother saying to her children, "Will you please be quiet?" She asks the children to be quiet so that she is not disturbed. But her desire is for more than external quietness. It is a desire to go to a deeper state of silence. Consciously or unconsciously, everyone desires to go to the deep state of silence, which is restful and refreshing and opens the gate of new dimensions of life. Often, silence answers the questions that are not answered in any other way or by any other means. The systematic method that leads one to the deepest state of silence is called meditation. Sleep is very necessary for all creatures of the world in order to have physical and mental rest. But the rest acquired through meditation is far superior to the rest given by sleep. There is a difference between sleep and the deep state of silence. The ignorant person sleeps every day and comes out of sleep no less ignorant, because sleep offers only rest. But if one learns to go to a deep state of meditation, he is rested, and at the same time his whole personality is transformed. That transformation cannot be attained without the inward method of meditation. Through meditation, the mind attains a state of tranquility. Meditation leads to mastery of the mind, and with that mastery, one attains quietude. Such a tranquil and equable mind, having no desire for sense pleasures, also has mastery in the performance of actions. Those who have gone beyond the jabberings of mind, sankalpa and vikalpa, attain the highest state of yoga. Those who are not meditators experience only the known level of life. But with the help of meditation, one can have profound knowledge of all the subtle states within, and ultimately attain the deep state of silence. Such an aspirant alone can experience both the known and unknown levels of life. The human being is a citizen of the inner world. He is an inner dweller first, and a denizen of the external world afterwards. But ordinary people remain citizens of the external world and aliens to the internal world. The yogi and sage remains aware that he is an inner dweller always. Once, for example, when our master was sitting quietly and calmly, a prince came to visit him and said to him, "Sir, you seem to be lonesome." The master replied, "Because you have come. I have been enjoying in deep silence the conversation with my friend within. Now you have come, and therefore I have become lonesome." It is true that students, friends, and loved ones can make us lonesome. One should learn to establish friendship with the eternal friend within. Then he will never be lonely. Real meditators are never lonely. So those who do not want to be lonely should learn to meditate and go on doing meditation until they meet their beloved eternal friend who is seated in the silent chamber in everyone's being. Loneliness vanishes forever in that state of silence where the true friend resides. Loneliness and silence are two entirely different states of mind. In silence, one has company, but in loneliness, one is all alone. The yogis learn to attain that state of silence, and then they are able to realize directly the nature of both the external and internal worlds. Those yogis can observe both within and without from the height of tranquility. The ancient yogis found that loneliness is the greatest of all diseases, and that it has no remedy but to go to the deep state of silence where the eternal beloved is seated with long and tender arms to embrace one. That is the only therapy that removes loneliness. All company and associations in the external world eventually lead to separation, and then to loneliness. But if one becomes aware of the eternal friend, he can efficiently play his role in the grand drama of life, and will never become lonely. This knowledge is essential to remove the ignorance of loneliness. Then it does not matter which path one follows, or to which end of the earth he travels. Going to the deepest state of silence with the help of a systematized and organized method of meditation is the highest of all therapies, but modern therapists have not yet understood the importance of meditative therapy. Modern therapy provides only one aspect of therapy. It allows the patient to let out his repressions and suppressions through speech and action. The patient receives a little solace, but he does not attain the control necessary to prevent him from becoming a victim of disturbances. Most therapists are afraid of introducing meditational therapy because of lack of practical knowledge and fear of the unknown. However, many beneficial results can be obtained by introducing preliminaries, such as stillness of the body and evenness of the breath, which have proven very helpful to those who are emotionally imbalanced. If such practices are introduced in a gentle and systematic manner, many psychosomatic illnesses can be eliminated. What is the way for the people of the world who do not have much time for meditation and do not know the right method of meditation? The answer is to practice meditation in action, as the Bhagavad Gita teaches. Be conscious of the truth, the center of consciousness, and perform your actions selflessly, with non-attachment. No matter where you are, in your office, in the kitchen, in the shopping center, or in the midst of a crowd, meditation in action can be practiced. Learn not to forget the center of consciousness within you. Do not allow your mind to be scattered, and whatever you do, do it with full attention. Beneath all your deeds, there should be awareness of the center of consciousness within. If one thinks he is fit, he should practice meditation in silence. Otherwise, meditation in action is the message of the Bhagavad Gita, without which the path of action is difficult to tread. Verses 5 and 6.
Uddharet atmanatmanam, natmanam avasadayet, atmaiva hyatmano banduratmaiva ripuratmanah. Banduratmatmanastasya yenatmaivatmana jitah. Anatmanastu shatrutve vartetatmaiva shatruvat.
One should cause the deliverance of the self by the self. One should not make the self sink. Self alone is the kinsman of the self. Self alone is the enemy of the self. Self is the kinsman of his self by whom the self is conquered by the self. In the apparent enmity from non-self, the self alone is operating like an enemy. When the aspirant realizes that he is competent and resourceful, he gains confidence and begins following the inner path. Dependency on external resources cannot help him to tread that path. Having deep-rooted habits of depending on external resources leads the student again and again to search outside of himself. He thinks that visiting one shrine and then another, and going from one teacher to another, will help him. But the inner thirst remains unquenched. As long as one continues to seek the means and objects that give happiness in the external world, he does not find true happiness. So first of all, a student should be led to realize that he already has the means to tread the path of inner light, and that external crutches cannot fulfill and satisfy his desire. Searching in the external world is in vain. Seeking within is the only way. With firm determination, one must use his willpower to apply all the means that are at his disposal. One may strongly desire unfoldment and enlightenment, but as long as he does not find the right way and does not commit himself to a reliable and valid method of sadhana, he will be wasting his energy and might even meet disappointments that could kill his desire to continue seeking. When one gets into his inner world, he gradually realizes that that which he was seeking outside is actually within. He comes to understand that he is fully equipped and has all the means at his disposal to attain truth. Then he is on the path of inner light and knows that for attaining the self alone is needed. Self is attained by the self, and one's own resources are the only means for attainment. Treading the path of inner light is one of the greatest experiments that can be made by a human being. Darkness prevails in the external world when the sun is obscured. But if someone is with the sun all the time, he will never encounter darkness. In the inner world, the guiding light is always there, and one is never alone. But in the external world, One has to depend on resources that are not always at his disposal, and on the instructions of teachers and knowledge given by the scriptures. After one has examined the external resources and knows their limitations, he turns within. That is one of the brightest days in one's life. He is still a seeker, but he is no longer seeking in the external world. He has begun seeking within. One encounters many inexplicable phenomena in the internal world. He may be bewildered and overwhelmed for some time, unable to accept and adjust to the subtle experiences. But when he pursues his sadhana, he learns to differentiate between two types of experiences. Some are negative and some positive. Some are helpful and others unhelpful. Some are misleading and others leading. One learns to reject those experiences that are not helpful and to accept those that are helpful in order to march toward deeper states of being. If he has patience, tolerance, and reliance on his inner strength, he pursues his sadhana with full determination and learns to discriminate and choose that which is helpful from that which is not. As one explores the inner world, there can be great confusion at times, but with the help of sadhana and the guiding light within, one attains clarity of mind and crosses safely over all obstacles. He follows the eternal light within, and that light leads him to its source, the pure self. He, the seeker, light, the means. He is led to the kingdom of happiness, the pure self. Thus a seeker elevates himself by the self. A seeker should never allow himself to slip back to the grooves of his past habits. The self, indeed, is a real friend. If the seeker does not use his own resources within, but instead remains dependent on external resources, he becomes his own enemy. You are your own friend and your own enemy. He who has conquered his lower self through the guidance of his inner self is a friend to himself. But one who has not been able to conquer his lower self is his own enemy. For conquering the lower self, self-control is needed. Self-control is indeed a friend, and without it, the scattered forces of the mind create obstacles. A man of self-control and a man without self-control are like friend and foe, respectively. Students often project their incompetencies onto others and then blame them for their own inadequacies. That is an easy means of escape. No one wants to accept responsibility for his weaknesses and mistakes, but when the student becomes aware that he is his own friend and also his own enemy, then dawns the light of discriminative knowledge. That is another higher step attained in the path of self-realization. The student who does not have knowledge of the scriptures and has not been taught by a competent teacher is confused in discriminating between the real self, Atman, and the lower self, which is a constituent of primordial nature, Prakriti. The lower self is called the mere self. The mere self is comprised of the body, senses, breath, conscious mind, and unconscious mind, which constantly undergo change. It is called the mere self, or lower self, because of its ever-changing nature. Behind the lower self shines the light of the eternal. The pure self is never born, so it never dies. It is everlasting and unchanging. One should learn to distinguish the lower self from the higher self, for then one can learn to identify himself with the real self instead of with the mere self. Verses 7 through 9.
Jitatmanah prashantasya paramatma samahitah shitoshna sukha dukkheshu tatha manapamanayoh jnana vijnana triptatma kutastho vijitendriyah yukta ityuchate yogi samaloshtasma kanchanah suhrun mitrar yudasina madhyasta dveshya bandushu sadushvapi cha papeshu samabuddhir vishishyate.
The supreme self of one pacified and self-conquered is harmonized in cold and heat. pleasure and pain, as well as in honor and dishonor. His self, satiated by knowledge and realization, absolute, having conquered the senses, joined in yoga, he is called a yogi. Beholding a lump of clay, stone, or nugget of gold alike. One is distinguished who holds the same view toward an affectionate friend, an enemy, a stranger, a neutral person, one hated, a kinsman, toward the saintly, as well as the sinful. One who has successfully conquered this lower self with all its desires and appetites attains the highest state of uninterrupted peace, and he is above the influences of the pairs of opposites, such as pain and pleasure, heat and cold. Such a great one is made fully content by the wisdom gained through yogic sadhana. One who is firmly established in the constant awareness of Atman, pure self, is aware of the limited value of the mundane world, its objects, and sense pleasures. He is no longer enticed by the pairs of opposites. For him, a piece of rock and a heap of gold are alike. Such a yogi has attained perfection. One who has conquered the appetites of the lower self is called Jitātma. Such a yogi is free from all the charms and temptations of the external world and remains in self-delight. The joy that he finds within is not temporary and fleeting. By contrast, the pleasures that others seek outside are only temporary. The pleasures of the external world soon turn into pain, for in the absence of one, the other is experienced. But this is not the case with the joy of the yogi who is in the garden of delight all the time. It is not easy to recognize such a great yogi, because ordinary people always remain busy protecting the image they have of themselves. They call that honor. And in want of honor and name and fame, one gets caught by the image he creates for himself, which is a false identity, a reflection of the lower ego. But those yogis who tread the inner path go beyond name and fame, honor and dishonor, and remain in a state of perpetual joy and delight. Those who know both the real self and the mere self walk on the earth radiating their eternal delight through their behavior, and they are not concerned with name and fame, pain and pleasure. They care not who thinks what about them, because they always feel that they are strangers in the world. The world is but a resting camp for them, and never their home. They are usually misunderstood, for only a few human beings have the capacity to understand them. Only other sages who have gained wisdom and knowledge through inner attainment can understand such great ones. Previously, Sri Krishna taught Arjuna to be conscious of his honor, and that teaching does not contradict what is said here. Sri Krishna was reminding Arjuna of his duties by making him aware that he is a leader and a warrior, not a coward or ordinary person. Self-honor and self-respect remind one of his duties and the tasks he must fulfill. That kind of honor does not build a false image, but those who remain deluded by creating a false image because of their insecurities are not aware of their duties. They are selfish and egotistical and work only for sense gratification. Such people do not have self-respect because they know from within that they are not what they claim to be. They remain helpless because they are addicted to the pleasures of the senses, and they create defense mechanisms because of their fears and insecurities. These two kinds of people are quite distinct. One has true self-respect, whereas the other merely creates a false image. A teacher keenly observes the behavior of his students, and he finds that many students do not have respect for themselves. Instead, they condemn themselves and try to hide the unwanted parts of their personalities by creating masks for themselves. The images they present to others are based on their insecurities. That is unhealthy and hinders the growth of the student. A good student is aware of and reveres his real self, and he practices maintaining constant consciousness of the center within. That is real self-respect. And if one loses it, he becomes the victim of vanity and creates defense mechanisms. It does not matter to a sage whether anyone knows him or not, follows him or not. Only the prepared ones can understand the height of his realization and can be benefited. But Arjuna is a leader and a warrior who is already followed by millions. And if he does not have profound knowledge of his dharma, duty, he will not be honored and followed by ordinary people. His position is different than that of the sage. He needs to perform his dharma skillfully, selflessly, and lovingly. The behavior of a leader becomes an example for the masses. He should therefore be cautious, vigilant, and conscious of his duties so that he does not create confusion for others. Ordinary people usually honor their leaders and guides, but a true leader and guide remains untouched, uninfluenced, and unaffected by the honors bestowed on him by others. The great leaders and guides of humanity do not change their attitudes and lose their calm and balance because someone opposes them, someone misunderstands them, or someone does not follow them, for they are firm in the understanding that they are doing their dharma with full skill and confidence. Such great leaders treat saints and sinners alike. They do not judge others, but accept them as they are. They neither hate nor uselessly praise. The attitude of the sage toward the saint and the evildoer remains even, and his faculty of judgment is never affected by extremes. He does not favor the saint and is not cruel to the person who does evil. He has attained evenness, tranquility, and peace, which are beyond a concern with virtue and vice. According to Yogasadhana, this state of mind is called the witnessing state. One learns to witness what is going on, but does not involve himself in it. Verses 10 through 15.
Yogi yunjita satatam atmanam rahasi sthitah. Ekaki yata chittatma nirashir aparigraha. Shuchau deshe pratishthapya sthiramasanam atmanah. Natyuchritam natinicham chailajina kushottaram. Tatra ekagram manakrutva yata chittendriya kriyah. Upavishyasane yunjyat yogam atma vishuddhaye. Samam kaya shirogrivam, dharayan nachalam sthirah, samprekshanasikagram swam dishaschan avalokayan. Prashantatma vigatabir brahmachari vrate sthitah, manaha samyamya machitto yukto asita matparah. Yunjan evam sadatmanam yogi niyatamanasaha, shantim nirvana paramam, matsamstham adigacchati.
The yogi should incessantly place himself in yoga, dwelling in solitude, alone, his mind and self controlled, having no expectations, receiving no input into the senses. Placing one's stable seat in a clean place, neither too high nor too low, made of cloth, a black antelope skin, and kusha grass, one on top of the other. There, making the mind one pointed, with the mind, self, and movement under control, sitting on the seat, one should practice yoga for self-purification. Holding the trunk, head, and neck straight, unmoving and still, observing the point in front of the nose, and not looking in various directions. With a pacified self, with all fear banished, remaining in the vow of a celibate, controlling the mind, with the mind absorbed in me, one should dwell joined in yoga and intent upon me. Thus uniting himself in yoga, the yogi with a well-directed mind reaches that peace, the ultimate of which is absorption, nirvana, and the foundation of which is in me. From the 10th verse onward, a practical lesson is given that equally benefits ascetics and those living in the world. Knowledge received from sources other than the self no doubt helps and inspires the sadhaka. But without direct knowledge and experience of the self, the thirst for knowledge and attainment remains unquenched. When the sadhaka learns to light the fire of knowledge, he begins treading the path of purification. He thereby attains a state in which all his samskaras are burned, and he is purified. When we say that everyone needs to be purified, it means that the mind ordinarily functions like a slave to one's samskaras and past habits. Then, the mind is not functioning as an instrument of the self. A profound, precise, and practical method of controlling the mind and its modifications is necessary. When one develops a strong desire to know truth and realizes his helplessness, he has no alternative but to follow the path of sadhana, the path of inner experience, the path of light and delight. A yogi is he whose purpose of life is to unite himself with the absolute truth. The term yogi is used for those who are making sincere efforts and practicing to attain a state of samahita, samadhi, and those who have already attained samahita. The path they follow is called yoga sadhana. If one really has a burning desire to practice, then he begins treading the path of sadhana. For that purpose, a complete and practical method is expounded here. Deciding to go into solitude in order to follow the path of sadhana is the first dawning day of one's life. One needs a place where he can be free from all sorts of distractions, such as noise and visitors coming and going. The place one chooses should not be damp or too warm or too cold. The hours before sunrise and after sunset are best for meditation. At other times, one can practice yoga exercises. Both asanas and pranayama should be included in the practice. Physical exercise keeps the body fit, and pranayama is important for regulating the motion of the lungs. Without fitness of the body and control of the breath, sadhana cannot be practiced. Food is another important factor. Nutritious food that is simple, fresh, and properly chewed should be eaten according to one's capacity. But one's time and energy should not be concentrated on food. Sadhana alone should be the center of one's activities. Preparation for meditation is more important than the method of meditation. Without preparation of both the external environment and of oneself, meditation is not possible. The external environment should be kept neat and clean, undisturbed, and free from agitation. Anything that disturbs the mind creates an obstacle. The following conditions should be observed. 1. In the beginning stage, meditation should be practiced in a quiet and peaceful room where external sounds do not disturb the meditator. The room should be comfortable and not overly humid. Burning incense during meditation is injurious, but it can be burned before or after meditation if one wishes. 2. There are two sets of yoga asanas, postures, that should be practiced. The postures for physical culture keep the body firm and are thus complementary to the postures practiced for meditation. The seat upon which one meditates should not be too high, for there is a possibility that the meditator may fall, and if the seat is too low, insects may become a source of distraction. Another reason to keep oneself above the ground is to keep the body unaffected by the temperature and dampness. A wooden seat is preferred. It should be large enough so that one can sit comfortably. Wood is a poor conductor of heat and cold, and it is better than sitting on the ground or on metal or stone. Kusha is a grass that in ancient times was used as a base, and on top was a four-folded woolen blanket with a cotton spread over it. A tiger skin or deer skin was sometimes used instead of a blanket. Those were all used in order to have a cushion beneath and to insulate oneself from the ground, because in ancient times the aspirant meditated in a cave or outside. Modern conveniences to control temperature, humidity, insects, and such were not available. Thus, the instructions given in the Bhagavad Gita may be modified to suit one's conditions and the material available. 3. The meditator should sit in a posture that is comfortable and in which he can keep his body steady and his head, neck, and trunk straight. There are only a few postures that are used for meditation, and among these, the accomplished pose, Siddhasana, is preferable. One can also use the half lotus pose, Ardha Padmasana, or the easy pose, Sukhasana. The position one chooses is not so important. One can even choose to sit upright on a firm chair. That which is most important is to keep the head, neck, and trunk in a straight line and to arrange the upper and lower limbs in a definite way so that they do not create disturbance and discomfort for the body. 4. Having seated himself firmly in Siddhasana or in another posture, the meditator should gently close his eyes and focus the mind on the base of the bridge between the two nostrils. The word nasagre means in front of the two nostrils. It does not mean the tip of the nose, as some translators and commentators think, but the bridge between the two nostrils. By concentrating on that point, the meditator becomes aware of the flow of both breaths. It is unfortunate that most commentators have only superficially commented on this verse, for students may practice on the basis of erroneous interpretations and injure themselves. How can one gaze on the tip of the nose and call that meditation? There is an exercise like that, but it is called Trataka, gazing. It is a Hatha Yoga exercise for strengthening eyesight and concentration. It is not at all a part of meditation. The meditative method begins with the voluntary withdrawal of the senses, and not with concentration of the mind through external gazes. The word nasa does not mean the tip of the nose, but the nostrils, and agrabhage does not refer to the front of the tip of the nose. Rather, it is the juncture at which the bridge that separates the two nostrils meets the top of the upper lip. Thus the mind is fixed on the flow of both breaths, so that sushumna is applied. Ordinarily, one of the nostrils is predominant, but in sushumna, both breaths flow equally. 5. The mind and breath are independent. They react to one another. Breath is the barometer of the mind and the body, for it registers all the conditions of both. If something unusual happens in the mental world, the flow of the breath changes. And if the body is in pain or has a fever, the flow of the breath changes then as well. If one receives shocking news, the breath becomes more rapid, disturbing the motion of the lungs, the heart, the brain, and finally, the mind. By focusing the mind on the flow of breath, the mind experiences a joy of concentration that purifies it. Many breathing exercises, especially when one is in an emotionally intense state, have been proven to be useful. The breath and mind are two inseparable friends. 6. The purpose of meditation is threefold. First, to apply sushumna. Then, to become conscious of the unknown and hidden levels of life, which is also known as awakening the primal force, kundalini. And finally, to experience a state beyond by attaining samadhi. 7. In order to attain samadhi, the yogi takes a vow of celibacy. The word celibacy does not mean mere suppression of the sexual urge. Brahmacharya means walking in Brahman, being conscious of Brahman all the time. Brahma means Shakti, and Charya means how to direct. A Brahmachari is able to master and direct his energies toward the attainment of the highest state of consciousness. Brahmacharya is not limited to the control of the sexual urge, but also involves the control of the mind, action, and speech. all one's energies should be directed towards Brahman consciousness, so that the mind becomes one-pointed and turns inward. This inward flow of mental energy leads to the self, the center of consciousness. 8. Finally, a yogi fathoms many levels of experience in his inner world. Those experiences are inexplicably delightful. Such a great man finally attains a state of oneness with the pure self. Verses 16 and 17.
Natyashnatastu yogosti nachaikantam anashnatah nachati swapnashilasya jagrato naivacharjuna yuktahara viharasya yuktacheshtasya karmasu yuktaswapnavabodhasya yogo bhavati dukkaha.
There is no yoga for one who eats much, or who eats nothing at all, or for one who is inclined to excessive sleep, or one who awakes altogether, O Arjuna. He whose food and enjoyment are balanced, whose movements and action are balanced, whose sleeping and waking are balanced, his yoga becomes the eliminator of sorrows. Those who overeat and those who eat less than the body needs are not sensitive to the capacity of their bodies. They disturb their digestive systems and cannot regulate their bowels. Proper digestion is necessary for good health, and without good health, sadhana is not possible. When the yogi learns to regulate all the urges and refrains from overindulgence, he is able to attain profound control over his mind. But if one does not regulate his appetites by watching his capacity, perfection is never attained. Many students fallaciously think that rigid austerities should be practiced on the path of yoga. Some inexperienced aspirants go on fasts for a long time because they think that physical mortification can help them to purify both body and mind. It should be clear that except during a period of cleansing, in which one practices kriyas such as the internal wash, the upper wash, the lower wash, and the complete wash, fasting is not recommended. Too much fasting affects one's resistance, and he may become a victim of disease. Yoga is a middle path. In yoga sadhana, one should not touch the extremes, overeating or fasting, oversleeping or not sleeping enough. In the modern world, most people have not learned to regulate their appetites. They overindulge in sensual pleasures without taking heed of the harmful effects the indulgence has on their bodies and minds. Obesity, anorexia, and bulimia are three of the most frequent problems encountered by physicians and psychotherapists today. For most people, food is symbolic of love and nurturance, so they either use food as a substitute for love and nurturance, or they reject food as they reject the insincere love of their parents. Bulimics do both. Many people also overeat because of sexual frustration. Yogic practices lead one to become sensitive to the effects of overindulgence and austerities that are too severe. One is then able to find a natural balance in all areas of his life. Through sadhana, one learns to regulate all aspects of his functioning and to gain mastery over the body, senses, and mind. He keeps the body free from disease and weakness, and he keeps the mind free from disturbance. Verses 18 through 20.
Yada viniyatam chittam atmanyeva vatishthate nispruhaha sarvakamebhyo yukta ityuchyate tada. Yatha dipo nivatastho nengate sopamasmrita yogino yatachittasya yunjato yogamatmanah. Yatropa ramate chittam niruddham yogasevaya yatra chaivatmanatmanam pasyannatmani tushyati.
When a very well-controlled mind remains stable in the self alone, detached from all desires, then one is called joined in yoga. As a lamp in a place without breeze does not tremble. This is the simile of a yogi whose mind is controlled practicing the yoga of the self. Where the mind ceases, withdrawn through the observance of yoga, where one sees the self in the self, one is satiated in the self. In yoga sadhana, sanyama, self-discipline, is important. In fact, it is the very means for the renunciate to attain Brahman, for the yogi to attain samadhi, and for the man of action to perform his duty skillfully and selflessly. Non-attachment is part of that discipline. We have already explained that non-attachment and discipline should be properly understood. Discipline should not be seen as a punishment or as something imposed by teachers, and non-attachment should not be viewed as implying indifference, carelessness, or lack of love for others. Those who are not able to practice discipline cannot foresee its positive effects. They feel that discipline is not necessary. For fear of losing their little joys, they do not want to discipline themselves. So is the case with people who are attached to objects and human relationships, because they use all these as crutches and as a means to satisfy their sense gratifications. Such people misunderstand non-attachment. Non-attachment brings about the love divine, and it opens new horizons, which helps one understand that higher joys can be obtained in life. No one in this world is satisfied. Everyone understands that and accepts it as a fact of life. But most people are afraid of the unknown and do not search for something higher. The ordinary person is not sure that the search for the unknown will give him something higher than what he has already. He is not happy as he is, and yet is afraid of searching in the unknown. Dissatisfaction and fear are two great enemies of the human being. They create a great barrier in the process of unfoldment. The ordinary human being remains clinging to his dissatisfaction, not knowing anything better. But if he would begin to discipline himself and develop non-attachment, he would quickly begin to find something far better than what he leaves behind. When the roving mind of the aspirant is brought back from its dissipated nature to a center of focus by meditative practices, when his mind becomes steady and one-pointed, and when he does not long for worldly desires, he is called a yogi. It is necessary to explain what is meant by the object or center of focus for the mind. Every person has his own mind that differs from the nature of other minds. The capacity for perceiving and conceptualizing differs in both degree and quality. The object that is recommended to the student as a point of focus during meditation is therefore a delicate matter. If the object is disagreeable to the student, he cannot practice. He begins fighting within himself instead of letting go. There are already innumerable objects in the mind, for the mind itself manufactures numerous objects and expresses them through symbols, ideas, fantasies, hallucinations, and dreams. The question arises, how will adding one more object to the mind be helpful? Verse 19 tells us that the object of meditation should not be anything but Atman, the pure self. All of the objects created by the mind are partial and incomplete. But this object of meditation is all-encompassing and is the source of all other objects. That brings another question. How can one have as an object for his meditation something abstract, timeless, infinite, and eternal? To answer this question, it is necessary to distinguish between concentration and meditation, which are two different states and experiences on the inner path. There is no meditation in concentration, but there is already concentration in meditation. Many teachers these days think meditation can be attained without concentration. That ignorant idea is misleading. The mind as it is in its ordinary nature remains in a dissipated state, Without gathering together and concentrating the energy of the mind, the deeper state of meditation is not possible. The student who practices sitting in a quiet and calm place, even for a short time, can experience a bit of unusual joy, though he is not able to experience the deep joy of the meditative state. Why should one be afraid of concentration? Some say that concentration of mind can bring about strain and stress, and thus should not be practiced. They even say that discipline is not needed, and they create simplified methods and call them meditation. Such teachings appear to make difficult sadhana easy, but these easy methods do not lead one to the higher dimensions of life. For concentrating the mind, one needs something concrete, a form, image, or symbol that carries some meaning. Abstract thought can lead one to the contemplative state, but not to a concentrated state of mind. Prescribing an object for the concentration of mind requires a skilled teacher. The best concentration is achieved when the student mentally centers his mind on the flow of the breath. It is easy for the mind to become concentrated if the breath is the focal point. That has many benefits. First, the mind and breath, which are closely linked together, begin functioning in a coordinated way. When concentration is absent, the cooperation remains unconscious. It requires effort to establish coordination on a conscious level. Second, when the student concentrates on the breath, he is able to discover the defects in his breathing and becomes mentally aware of breathing patterns that need to be changed, such as jerky, noisy breathing, or habits of inhaling shallowly, or creating a pause between inhalation and exhalation. These bad habits are the source of many physical imbalances and illnesses that cannot be treated with medicine. In most great meditative traditions of the world, the breath is the center for focusing the mind. Only those teachers who do not have direct experience with the path of meditation and who have lost the sensitivity for the well-being of their students, prescribe a gross object as a focal point. With the breath as an object, the student is first led toward concentration, which gradually becomes more subtle. Following this fine thread of breath, he attains inwardness. The mind then acquires the capacity of subtlety, and one develops a penetrating sense of internal observation. Concentration and meditation should ultimately lead one to Atman alone. One-pointedness of mind is an important requisite to help one accomplish that. When one learns to concentrate on the breath and removes all the defects that he finds in his breathing patterns, he tries to understand who it is that is inhaling and exhaling. There are traditions that believe in the coordination of mantra with breath at this stage. Mantra is a Sanskrit word, sound, syllable, or set of words. It is a means to remove all the impurities of mind. There are a few mantras that are used while inhaling and exhaling that do not disturb the flow of breath. The sadhaka reaches a point in his practice where he not only breathes the air, but constantly remembers the mantra with each inhalation and exhalation. That leads the mind to constant awareness of the mantra. When the consciousness of the mantra is deepened, the mantra is able to guide the mind in the inner world. The student is then taught to be aware of the inner light that already burns without flickering. When the mind experiences that light, it elevates itself to a state of joy that it did not experience before. That light which is within us is the finest and best form upon which to meditate. Without that light, we would not be able to see, observe, verify, and discriminate anything in the external world. It is the light of consciousness that is experienced in a concentrated form. The mind then begins to see clearly. It is no longer clouded. Then the light of consciousness and mantra become one, because at that stage, the mantra is not actually remembered, but its meaning and feeling are revealed. At first, one remembers and repeats the mantra in a gross way. but gradually it is experienced in a more subtle way. When one develops the feeling of constant awareness of the mantra, it unites with the main stream of consciousness, where light and sound are inseparably mingled. That is a perfect state of concentration. One has then attained profound control of the mind, and he experiences a constant closeness and union with the self-illuminated Atman. When the sadhaka has mastered the art of concentration, his mind is fixed on the self only. The mind of an ordinary person is dissipated, disturbed, and fickle, but the mind of the sadhaka attains steadiness. Such a sadhaka has mastered and controlled the usual flow of mental energy that goes out to the external world. From the very beginning, the object of concentration must be carefully chosen. At first, it should be the breath, and later, breath with mantra, well coordinated and united. In a higher stage, sound and light are united, and in the highest state, pure consciousness alone exists. Meditation is an inward process of therapy. It is able to remove all the impurities and weaknesses that are responsible for creating disorder and illness. Meditational therapy is quite different from hypnosis. In a hypnotic state, instead of having a direct experience of the unknown dimensions of life, one is influenced by suggestions from someone outside, or by self-suggestion. Therapy based on hypnosis is an unguided method, for the therapist and client do not know what they will encounter next. They are being guided by their conscious and unconscious minds, but not by the light of consciousness. Many times in such cases, the therapist loses touch with the client, and the client with his consciousness. Many terrifying experiences may come from the unconscious of the client when the hypnotist is not able to maintain control over the hypnotic session. That form of therapy goes only so far. The great therapists of the past had to abandon that method, although lately hypnosis has been developed further and used successfully in certain cases. But those who practice hypnosis can never develop a profound training program that independently leads one to the source of knowledge and light. By contrast, on the path of meditation, one is led to self-realization. Verses 21 through 23.
Sukham atyantikam yattad buddhigrahyam atindriyam. Veti yatra nachaivayam stitaschalati tatvataha. Yam labdhva chaparam labham manyate nadikam tataha. Yasmin stito na dukkhena gurunapi vichalyate. Tam vidya dukkha sanyoga viyogam yoga sangitam. Sa nischayena yoktavyo yogo nirvinna chetasa.
The ultimate happiness is that which is grasped by intelligence and is beyond the senses. When one knows this happiness, dwelling in it, he no longer moves from the knowledge of that reality. Attaining which one no longer believes any other gain to be greater than that, staying in which one is not shaken even by the greatest sorrow. Now, that elimination of union with sorrows is to be known as yoga. That yoga should be practiced resolutely by one who has made his mind dispassionate. When the light of pure reason begins guiding the yogi, he is no longer victimized by the distress that is experienced by ordinary people. Then, distraction and distress do not affect him in any way. That which is taken as a great calamity by the ordinary person is nothing serious for the yogi, because he has attained the state of perfection by controlling the senses and mind and all its modifications. The word perfection is used in many situations. One can be considered to be perfect in many different things, such as in writing, singing, gymnastics, and so on. But here, perfection means that state of perfect control over the mind. The yogi attains that state only after his mind is fully concentrated and uninterruptedly flows toward the center of consciousness. This is a deep state of meditation, one of the stages of samadhi. These verses explain that through the meditative method, buddhi becomes one-pointed, sharp, and able to fathom the subtler levels of life to which the sense organs have no access. The joy that is then experienced is unmeasurable and inexplicable, beyond the grasp of sense organs and mind. When one experiences this state, there is no chance that he may slip back to desiring the sense enjoyments, because he has already attained that joy which is infinitely superior to sensory pleasures. Verses 21, 22, and 23 explain the joyful experience of the yogi who has mastered his senses, mind, and buddhi. One who realizes this eternal joy experiences many benefits. 1. He is cheerful, calm, content, and undisturbed in all situations. 2. He does not depend on the senses to supply pleasure, for his joy is a million times higher than that attained from sensory pleasure. 3. He is not at all dependent on external experiences, for he has become self-reliant. 4. His is a joy that is experienced by the self only. Self delights in self. 5. His meditation is profound, and he is so established in meditation that he cannot do otherwise. He meditates all the time. 6. His happiness is of a supreme quality. It is infinite, and words have no power to measure or explain it. 7. When that joy is attained, one is firm in knowing that there is no joy higher than that. In the first chapters of the Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna identifies himself with his negative personality. So Sri Krishna leads him to remember his true self. Arjuna then leaves his grief behind and commits himself to the yoga of perfection, mastery, and joy. That joy is unparalleled in its nature and is experienced directly from the fountain of joy itself. It does not depend on any object. It is a profound love without a beloved. It is love without an object, meditation without an object. Meditation is like falling in love. The difference is that ultimately it has no object, whereas love in the external world is held captive by the object. Verses 24 through 28.
Sankalpa prabhavan kaman stektva sarvan asheshatah manasai vendriyagramam viniyamya samantatah shanai shanai ruparamet buddhya drutigruhitaya atma saustam manakrutva nakinchidapi chintayet yato yato nischarati manas chanchalam asthiram tatastato niyamyaita datmanyeva vasham nayet. Prashanta manasam hyenam yoginam sukhamuttamam upaiti shanta rajasam brahma dhutam akalmasham yunjan evam sadatmanam yogi vigata kalmasha sukhena brahma sausparsham atyantam sukhamashnute.
Giving up all desires born of volition in their entirety, controlling the entire group of senses with the mind alone and from all sides, slowly, slowly one should turn away with the help of intelligence, which is held in steadfastness, making the mind stable in the self. Then one should think entirely of nothing. In whatever direction the fickle and unstable mind wanders out, from that very direction one should pull it and bring it under the control of the self alone. The best happiness comes only to such a yogi whose mind is pacified, whose dust has settled, who has become identified with Brahman, and who is free of all stains. Thus uniting the self in yoga, the yogi, free of all stains, easily enjoys the ultimate happiness, which is contact with Brahman. Verses 24 through 28 present a profound description of sadhana and inspire the aspirant. These verses also refer to the dark side of human nature and teach the student not to do that which is harmful to him. The pure self should be the center of activity. From morning until evening, and from evening until the next morning, all of the aspirant's activities should be directed only toward the attainment of self. Because diversions are many, habits are strong, and attractions are immense, one needs a one-pointed mind, strong determination, and willpower. Otherwise, he will not be able to accomplish the purpose of life. With the help of concentration, the sadhaka gathers together the dissipated forces of mind. With full strength, he begins walking the path of the inward journey. One who is able to put his rajasic activities to rest consciously and voluntarily, whose mind has attained a state of quietness, finds his way in the world of inner experiences. Free from desire for pleasure and sense gratification, such a yogi identifies himself with his essential nature, the pure self. This state of mind is not the result of sadhana practiced half-heartedly or sporadically. Rather, it results from that sadhana which is given the highest priority. Then, all the activities of life, thought, speech, and action, become auxiliary to sadhana. If the aspirant has patience and only one desire to fulfill, self-realization, then alone that state is attained. Modern students lack patience and determination. They want quick results without working hard. They are like children who sow the seed and pour water over it, and the next morning dig up the seed to find out why it has not grown. Patience is a great virtue in sadhana. One who continues to follow the path of sadhana with firm determination and does not change his path no doubt attains the permanent abode of the eternal. Suppose one's purpose is to travel to a distant city. One day he rushes forward on a road that leads to that city, but after a few hours of effort, he turns back, and the next day sets out on a different route. If he continues to do that, he will never reach his destination. The following are essential for an aspirant. 1. He should have profound knowledge of the path he is treading. 2. He should be fully equipped before he treads the path. That means he should discipline himself. 3. He should patiently and steadily tread his path. He should not forget his goal, no matter what he does, whether he is studying, eating, or exercising. 4. The law of karma states that nothing is wasted and nothing is lost. One is bound to receive the fruits of his actions sooner or later. The student should have faith that his sadhana will not be wasted. 5. Before eating, sleeping, or practicing meditation, and as many times as it is convenient and possible, one should dedicate his sadhana and surrender the fruits to the Lord of Life. By following these principles, the sadhaka develops awareness of the eternal and is no longer distracted by the temporal world. He experiences the greatest of all joys and happiness, which arise in the depths and heights of his inner self. Verses 29-32.
Sarva bhutastam atmanam sarva bhutani chatmani. Ikshate yoga yuktatma sarvatra samadarshanah. Yo mam pashyati sarvatra, sarvam cha mai pashyati, tasyaham na pranashyami, sachame na pranashyati. Sarva bhuta sthitam yo mam bhajat yekattva mastitah. Sarvatha vartamanopi sa yogi mai vartate. Atma upam yena sarvatra samam pashyati yorjuna. Sukham va yadiva dukham, sa yogi paramo matah.
One whose self is joined in yoga, looking evenly at everything, sees the self dwelling in all beings, and all beings in the self. He who sees me everywhere and sees everything in me, for him I do not vanish, nor does he vanish from me. He who, established in unity, devotes himself to me, who am dwelling in all beings, though operative in manifold ways, that yogi still remains in me. He who sees everything alike as similar to himself, O Arjuna, whether in comfort or discomfort, he is considered to be the highest yogi. The self-realized yogi sees the eternal, omnipresent, omniscient, pure self everywhere. He sees himself in all, and all in himself. He realizes that the self, the Lord of life, is in all beings, and all are in the Lord. He knows that he cannot be separated from the universal consciousness, for he is one with it, and is virtually that universal consciousness. Such a yogi's mind dwells in the state of evenness. For him, pain and joy are the same, yet he remains sensitive to the pain and misery of others. He is aware of that which causes misery, and also of that which brings worldly pleasure. His yoga practices and the attainment of a deep meditative state do not lead him to the black hole of nothingness, but enable him to sympathize, love, help, and serve, yet to remain in a state of tranquility. He is gifted with the special quality of knowledge through which he feels pain for those who suffer as though it were his own suffering. Such is the state of a yogi who is endowed with the great gift of sensitivity and yet is able to maintain evenness at the same time. He has the capacity to feel the misery of others, but is not affected by it. He has learned the profound art of living and being. He lives in the world, but is not of it. The true meaning of the word samatvam, evenness, can only be realized by meditators and yogis. Others can merely intellectualize and speculate about its meaning. When the yogi touches the timeless and infinite knowledge in deep meditation, he is able to see the present, past, and future, and can attain comprehensive knowledge of all three dimensions at a glance. Such a yogi has attained samatvam. He sees Atman everywhere. For him, time, space, and causality do not create any limitations. With this limitless knowledge, his mind becomes even, samatva. He loves all equally and hates none. He includes all and excludes none. The yogi maintains his individuality, yet is always fully conscious of Atman. Being one with the eternal, he is free from destructibility, even though the objects of the world are ever-changing and subject to destruction. Such a yogi releases himself from the conditionings created by the three gunas and from the limitations of time, space, and causation. The entire chain of life, from the unknown to the known, and the known to the unknown, from birth to death, and death to the hereafter, is unveiled to him and reveals its secret. He is the knower of all events, yet he is free from the changes he experiences. Such a great one is like a tank that is overflowing with water. The tank maintains its individuality, even though the same water is both within and without, and all around. The perennial flow of knowledge fills the yogi and keeps him overflowing. He is constantly aware of his eternal existence, but he still maintains his higher ego for the sake of serving others, rather than for maintaining his individuality. He is firmly established in uninterrupted consciousness of the Absolute. The peace found in that state is a living peace, not like the peace one finds in a cemetery or in isolation. Such peace does not come to one who withdraws himself from his duty because he feels that he is not able to perform his duty skillfully. That peace comes only to one who stands at the edge that unites the human and divine. Such a yogi is considered to be a person of great wisdom and is adored by all. Verses 33 through 36.
Arjuna uvacha. Yoyam yogastvaya proktaha samyena madhusudana एतस्याहं न पश्यामि चञ्चलत्वा स्थितिं स्थिराम् चञ्चलमि मनःकृष्ण प्रमाथि बलवद्दृढम् तस्याहं निग्रहं मन्ये वायोरिव सुदुष्करम् श्रीभगवानुवाच असंशयं महाबाहो मनो दुर्निग्रहं चलम् अभ्यासेनुत कौन्तेय वैराग्येण च गृह्यते असंयतात्मना योगो दुष्प्राप इति मे मतिः वश्यात्मना तु यतता शक्यो वाप्तुम् उपायतः.
Arjuna said, I do not see the stability of this yoga through equanimity that you have taught, O Krishna, to be lasting, because of the mind's fickleness. The mind is indeed fickle, turbulent, very powerful, and strong. I believe its control to be as difficult as that of the wind. The Blessed Lord said, No doubt, O Arjuna, the mind is difficult to control, and ever moving. But, O son of Kunti, it can be held through practice and dispassion. Yoga is difficult to be found by someone whose self is not in control. This is my view. But by someone who endeavors with a controlled self, it can be attained by appropriate methods. Arjuna accepts the validity of the teachings imparted to him, but like any student, he wonders if it is really possible for him to attain the yoga of equanimity, for he recognizes that the mind is very restless, obstinate, and difficult to control. In the Vedas, Upanishads, and many other scriptures, the mind is considered to be both an obstacle and at the same time a means of liberation. The conscious part of the mind is but a small part of the whole of the mind. Modern education makes an effort to cultivate only the conscious mind, which functions during the waking state. The rest of the mind remains unknown. That unknown part of the mind is called the unconscious. The functioning of the unconscious is difficult for the aspirant to comprehend and control. When the yogi talks of controlling the mind, it means the whole of the mind, not just the conscious part. Arjuna says that controlling the mind is comparable to controlling the wind, for it is impossible for anyone to have control over the wind. The purpose of yoga sadhana is to understand the mind and its modifications, the way the mind functions in both the external and internal worlds, and to develop control over the mind. Self-control is that state in which one is not swayed by selfish desires or by the sense pleasures that are responsible for creating injurious ties of attachment. Attaining self-control is truly a difficult task. Hearing Arjuna's uncertainty, Sri Krishna replies, O Arjuna, no doubt the mind is dissipated and difficult to control. But when the sadhaka consistently makes sincere effort to isolate the mind from the objects of enjoyment and attachment, he can attain control of it. Vairagya, non-attachment, is an important means to attain control of the mind. It should be understood and practiced. The human being's stay in the mundane world is very brief. On the path to eternity, this world is just one of the camps. Therefore, do not become attached to it. Always remember that this is not your permanent abode. Everyone is brought to that awareness many times in life. But again, the strong desire for enjoying sensory pleasure distracts the mind. When someone very dear to us dies, and we take that person's body to the cemetery, everyone there feels the presence of Vairagya, whispering its profound lesson. We are born to die. There is nothing in this world that is permanent and not subject to death. Death is an alarm that makes every human being realize that attachment to sense pleasures, to things of the world, and to relationships is painful. Vairagya is the knowledge that dawns each time we go off the path and become attached to something of the world, for invariably that attachment causes pain and leads us to give up that attachment. That knowledge draws us, but strong habits and the desire to enjoy sensory pleasure do not allow us to pay heed to it. At the cemetery, the knowledge of vairagya dawns for a short time. Everyone at the cemetery suddenly becomes a sage and begins realizing and talking about the impermanent nature of the temporal world. During that time, everyone is attuned to one and the same reality. But after the body is buried and the mourners turn toward their homes, they forget the lesson that they received at the cemetery. Once more, they become busy doing the same things as before. Gain and loss are two experiences that the human being repeatedly encounters throughout life. When one gains something temporal, he becomes imbalanced and overjoyed, and when he loses it, he is plunged into sadness. Whatever is gained will sooner or later be lost. When one becomes aware that these two experiences always occur together, he realizes that attachment is unhealthy and the source of much misery. The yogi knows that sooner or later he will have to lose even the most well-loved things in the world. He constantly remembers that change is inevitable in the external world. He learns to maintain constant consciousness of the pure self and adjusts himself to the changing situations of the mundane world. To gain mastery over the mind, the development of non-attachment is essential. By practicing a well-designed sadhana and applying all the means one has, he can attain mastery. Creating one's own method of sadhana will not help in gaining control of the mind, action, and speech. The proper means are those that have already been experienced by the great yogis in the past. Verses 37 through 39.
Arjuna Vacha. Ayati Shraddhayopeto Yoga Chalita Manasaha Aprapya Yoga Samsiddhim Kamgatim Krishna Gachati Kachinno Bhaya Vibrashtas Chinnabramiva Nashyati Apratishto Mahabaho Vimudo Brahmanapati Etanme Samshayam Krishna Chetu Marhas Yasheshataha Vadanya Samshayas Yasya Cheta Nakyupapadyate.
Arjuna said, "One who does not make full effort but maintains faith, his mind slipping away from yoga, thereby not attaining full accomplishment in yoga, what state does he come to, O Krishna? Does he, perchance, fallen from both, vanish like a broken-up cloud established in nothing, O Krishna, lost on the path of Brahman? Do indeed sunder this doubt in my mind, O Krishna, in its entirety. There is no other who can appropriately be considered a remover of this doubt." In these verses, Arjuna asks the same questions that are often asked by modern students. Even when a student tries his best, is faithful to his sadhana, and has firm faith in the path, he still encounters failures, and may find himself on a plateau from whence he feels incapable of attaining his goal. With that concern, Arjuna wants to know what happens to such people, and if there is an alternative path to follow. Sometimes, despite his sincere efforts, the aspirant does not make progress on his inner path. That creates serious confusion in the mind of the aspirant, and he may find himself lost, not fit for either the path of spirituality or for the path of the world. On the path to eternity and spirituality, one is like a pilgrim. Why should one be denied his right to complete his pilgrimage if he is sincere, truthful, and makes efforts with all his skill? Why is his path suddenly blocked? Why is he left in a state of limbo? These doubts not only affect Arjuna, but all aspirants. Verses 40 through 45.
Shri Bhagavan Uvacha. Partha naiveha namutra vinashas tasya vidyate nahi kalyana krit kaschid durgatim tata gachati prapya punya krutam loka nushitva shashvati samaha shuchinam shrimatam gehe योगभ्रष्टो भी जायते अथवा योगिनामेव कुले भवति धीमताम् एतद्धि दुर्लभतरम् लोके जन्म यदीदृशम् तत्र तम् बुद्धिसंयोगम् लभते पौर्वदेहिकम् यतते च ततो भूयः संसिद्धौ कुरुनन्दन पूर्वाभ्यासेन तेनैव ह्रियते ह्यवशोऽपि सः जिज्ञासुरपि योगस्य शब्दब्रह्माति वर्तते प्रयत्नाद्यतमानस्तु योगी संशुद्धकिल्बिषः अनेकजन्मसंसिद्धिस्ततो याति परां गतिम्
तपस्विभ्योऽधिको
योगी ज्ञानिभ्योऽपि मतोऽधिकः
कर्मिभ्यश्चाधिको
योगी
तस्मात् योगी
भवार्थनम् योगिनामपि सर्वेषाम् मद्गतेनान्तरात्मना श्रद्धावान् भजते यो माम्
But in the worlds of performers of meritorious deeds, dwelling there for long periods, one who has fallen from yoga is born in the homes of pure and glorious people, or he is born in the family of wise yogis. A birth such as this is very difficult to come to in this world. There he again gains union with the wisdom that came from his previous body. Then he undertakes further endeavor toward full accomplishment, O Prince of Kurus. Because of that previous habit of practicing, he is carried, even without his will. Desirous of knowing yoga, he transcends the verbal knowledge of God. Purified of sins, endeavoring with effort, reaching accomplishment in more than one lifetime, then he attains the supreme state. In order to dispel the doubts of Arjuna, Sri Krishna explains that good deeds and good actions never vanish into nothingness. There is no evil power that can obstruct one from receiving the positive outcome of his sincere efforts. Arjuna thinks that there is no place for one who has failed to attain perfection in yoga, either in the world or on the path of spirituality. That is not true. Only a few aspirants attain perfection in this birth, but others continue treading the path and are born again. Those who are not completely successful in treading their paths are born into families where they again have the opportunity to pursue their quest. Suppose one cannot complete his work today, and that work is very important. Does he not try to complete the task the next day? After death, the samskaras that are not fulfilled remain in the unconscious, and those desires and motivations compel the individual soul to assume a new garment called the body. Thus one does not begin afresh from the very beginning, but continues from the point he last reached. Such a great task as self-realization cannot possibly be accomplished in the small span of a single lifetime. Birth does not happen by chance or by accident. It is not an event that occurs suddenly out of nowhere. If it were, one human being would not carry certain motivations, desires, and abilities that differ from those of another. Western thinkers are still bewildered by this philosophy. They are trying to find the answer to why one is born with certain characteristics in the world. Some great Western thinkers and philosophers believe in the philosophy of rebirth, but most psychologists do not accept the validity of reincarnation. Psychologists spend their time debating over whether heredity or learning is responsible for an individual's unique characteristics. They are trying to discover the answers by intellectualization and experiments conducted on superficial levels. Many cases of reincarnation and rebirth are documented every year in both the East and West. Those who have been following the spiritual path have access to the infinite library of their memories of the past and can recall them with full clarity. Without examining all the levels of consciousness of human life, how can one claim or prove that he did not exist before, yet exists now? This very existence is proof that one has existed before. Sri Krishna explains to Arjuna that the yogi who could not complete his task does not remain in limbo, but starts again and completes his task in a future birth. He is born into a good family that offers him an environment conducive to the completion of his task. Such an aspirant sometimes feels that some unknown power is leading and guiding him to follow the path. It is actually his own powerful desire brought from the past that compels him to tread the path once again. But he is not conscious of that fact because his brain and the environment are new. On the path of spirituality, if one is sincere and faithful but does not have the right means and environment, he cannot progress. The right means are a healthy body, a healthy environment, a sound and clear mind, determination, willpower, self-confidence, and non-attachment. If any of these means is absent, progress is obstructed. But when the environment is conducive and the above mentioned means are strengthened, the difficulties one has encountered before are removed and the path becomes easy. One then attains perfection. Typically, students remain unaware of their potentials for many years. Sometimes, a mental shock, a conversation with a sage, or visiting a familiar place reminds one of his past, and he can come in touch with that aspect of his personality that remained unknown until that point. Most students want to know how many births are required to complete the journey to self-realization. That is decided by the aspirant and not by Providence or by the teacher. If the aspirant learns to apply all his resources to make his mind one-pointed and inward, he can attain his goal in this lifetime. In this lifetime. For those who have a wick, lamp, and oil, and put them together, their lamp is ready to be lit. It is true that when the disciple is ready, the master appears. Lighting the lamp depends on both the disciple and the master. The aspirant's lamp is lit by the master, but one should not forget that that light is not the light of the master, but was handed over to him in the same manner by the spiritual tradition. Verses 46 and 47.
Tapasvibhyodhiko yogi jnanibhyopi matodhikah karmibhyaschadhiko yogi tasmat yogi bhavarjuna yoginam api sarvesham madgatena antaratmana shraddhavan bhajate yomam same yuktatamo matah.
The yogi excels the ascetics. He is believed to be greater even than those endowed with knowledge. The yogi is greater than those who perform actions. Therefore, become a yogi, O Arjuna. Among all the yogis, he who faithfully devotes himself to me with his inner self entered into me, I consider him the one most united in yoga. Verse 47 refers to the 37th verse and answers Arjuna's question regarding an alternate path if one has not attained perfection on the path of yoga. As one jacket does not suit all, so one path does not suit all. As one jacket does not suit all, so one path does not suit all. Diverse are the paths, but the goal is one. The path of yoga is greater than the path of practicing austerities, for austerities are merely means to purify the mind. Austerities are external observances that are limited to physical cleanliness and to the control of the senses. They are practiced in many ways, by the ignorant in a rigid way, and by the knowledgeable for the sake of purification of the body and senses. The yogi also practices austerities, but he goes further and practices higher sadhana in order to attain control over the mind and its modifications. He then directs all his mental energy toward the center of perfection, His goal is to attain samadhi, and he does not rest until he attains it. There is another category of yogis whose minds are completely devoted, who have perfect faith, and who have completely surrendered themselves to the pure self alone. They are considered to be special children of God. They are the chosen ones. Sri Krishna makes this comparison between different types of aspirants to help Arjuna understand that unwavering faith is a strong force that can lead the devotee to the highest perfection. The path of love in which one learns to give with reverence and dedication all that one has unhesitatingly and unquestioningly requires great strength. Therefore, commitment to that path is higher than commitment to the path of austerities. Here, for the first time, Sri Krishna mentions the path of devotion. The path of devotion is not the emotionalism that leads people toward chanting, dancing, shaking, and tears. It is complete giving until one has nothing further to give. The Lord says, "Empty thy vessel, and I will fill thee." To be completely emptied, one must learn to be like the ocean. For the ocean continually evaporates itself, yet is always full. By giving, the same is returned. The law of giving fulfills one. Love is giving and fulfillment. Here ends the sixth chapter, in which the path of meditation and a glimpse of alternate paths are described.